Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 18th, 2006. Today's session is entitled Exploring the U.S.-American Cultural Iceberg. Is Competition Our State Religion? Presented by Jeff Kirsten Gripe. Number KGJ2006-02. Let's listen in.
My name is Jeff Kirsten Gripe. I teach at the University of Portland in communication studies, and intercultural communication is my absolute favorite thing to teach. I think it's our best alternative to violence. Otherwise, it's just might makes right, you know? That if we don't have both the will and the skills, we are stuck there doing things because we're bigger and we're badder than everybody else. Tonight's focus is the closest this course will get to docking somewhere that I described yesterday's session, that this is mostly a series about navigating the ship, regardless of where the ship eventually ports. But what we're looking at are the things that you should pay attention to regardless of where you port. Yesterday's topic was, you know, what counts as a culture? What does it mean to have a culture? Does Holden, for example, have a culture? We're pretty unanimous last night in thinking that it does. It has this historically transmitted system of symbols and meanings that kind of go from person to person to person and outlive the people who are here. If you haven't been here for a couple of decades, you come back and most of it still feels kind of familiar. That's because the system, the symbol system is there. But tonight I wanted to talk a little bit about the American iceberg. I wanted to read to you from an ethnography of culture. I don't know if you've heard of this article. This is by Horace Minor. It's called Body Ritual Among the Nacarema. And I want to read to you about this culture and see what you think. The Nacarema are a North American group living in the territory between the Canadian Cree, the Yaqui and Tarahumare of Mexico, and the Carib and Arawak of the Antilles. Little is known of their origin, although tradition states that they came from the east. According to Nacarema mythology, their nation was originated by a culture hero, Natinsaw, who was otherwise known for two great feats of strength, the throwing of a piece of wampum across the river Potomac, and the chopping down of a cherry tree in which the spirit of truth resided. Nacarema culture is characterized by a highly developed market economy, which has evolved in a rich natural habitat. While much of the people's time is devoted to economic pursuits, a large part of the fruits of those labors and a considerable portion of the day are spent in ritual activity. The focus of this activity is the human body, the appearance and health of which loom as a dominant concern in the ethos of Nacarema people. While such a concern is certainly not unusual, its ceremonial aspects and associated philosophy are unique. The fundamental belief underlying the whole system appears to be that the human body is ugly and that its natural tendency is to debility and disease. Incarcerated in such a body, man's only hope is to avert these characteristics through the use of powerful influences of ritual and ceremony. Every household has one or more shrines devoted to this purpose. The more powerful individuals in the society have several shrines in their houses, and in fact, the opulence of a house is often referred to in terms of the number of such ritual centers it possesses. The focal point of the shrine is a box or a chest which is built into the wall. In this chest are kept the many charms and magical potions without which no native believes he could live. These preparations are secured from a variety of specialized practitioners. Beneath the charm box is a small font. Each day, every member of the family in succession enters the shrine room, bows his head before the charm box, mingles different sorts of holy water in the font, and proceeds with a brief rite of ablution. The holy waters are secured from the water temple of the community, where priests conduct elaborate ceremonies to make the liquid ritually pure. The daily body ritual performed by everyone includes a mouth rite. Despite the fact that these people are so punctilious about the care of the mouth, this rite involves a practice which strikes the uninitiated stranger as revolting. It was reported to me that the ritual consists of inserting a small bundle of hog hairs into the mouth, along with certain magical powders, and then moving the bundle in a highly formalized series of gestures. Our review of the ritual life of the Nacarema, which of course is American backwards, has certainly shown them to be a magic-ridden people. It is hard to understand how they have managed to exist so long under the burdens which they have imposed upon themselves, but even such exotic customs as these take on real meaning when they are viewed with the insight provided by Malinowski, when he wrote, "Looking from far and above, from our high places of safety in a developed civilization, it is easy to see all the crudity and irrelevance of magic. But without its power and guidance, early humans could not have mastered practical difficulties as they have done, nor could humans have advanced to the higher stages of civilization. So I just find this really fascinating because it's like it's forcing me, like a fish, to see the water. We don't look at the water. We just swim in it. Clifford Geertz has an expression that the hardest thing to do as a member of a culture is to make the familiar strange. I remember Sunday school class for the first time in Lutheran. This is Lutheran land, Northern Minnesota. I remember we had kind of a controversial Sunday school series once. I think I was in fifth or sixth grade, and our teachers took us around to different churches, different denominations. I think we went to a Methodist church. We went to a... I remember the way out there when we went to a Catholic church. And I had never seen anybody genuflect before. And it occurs to me now that, you know, we just kind of walked in and sat down, and all those other people coming in and, you know, doing the kneeling thing and then sitting down, that if I waited just a couple of minutes and then tapped one of the people who went to that church and said, why do you do that? They would turn around and say, do what? That to them it's unremarkable. It's not something they see. You only see it if you're a stranger to the culture. So one of the goals I hope to get done tonight is that we look at American culture, Nacarema culture, with some nuance, that we look at it as maybe it's a culture full of ritual and magic, and that more advanced civilizations would look at us and wonder which of our things are. In fact, is that a toilet or is it a shrine? You know, what is that thing? And what sense would they make of a bidet? I'm hoping that we can look at American culture with some new eyes tonight, and I'm looking for a couple of different influences that I think are pretty profound in American culture. Now, to do this well, I'm going to have to divide the group in half. I think it's kind of ironic that your shirt says orphan. I want to have you have, if you wouldn't mind staying in the room, and I'm going to ask you folks actually to step outside for a minute. I have two different tasks for you to do together. So maybe you can introduce yourselves to each other so you know each other by name, and actually arrange yourselves in a little bit of a circle, if you would. Does someone in each group have something to write on or else a very good memory?
Hello.
Okay.
I'm Bob.
All right.
And I'm Ruth.
Okay.
Nancy.
Louisa.
I'll be right back.
And I'm Aaron.
Can we borrow a piece of paper?
You can write on the back of something here that's
You can have that.
Yeah, I've got extra something. Do you want a bigger piece of paper?
Looks like we're
going to You're going to take some minutes.
Yes.
I see there's three of them gone by
already. Just want to throw it all over the time.
What's the orphan?
This is a shirt left over.
I'm a student at Pacific Lutheran University, and they had an AIDS Awareness Day. There's a statistic that says within the next year or two, 10% of the children in Africa will be orphaned because their parents will die by AIDS. So to raise awareness, they gave 10% of the student body, through 3,000 people's student body, these shirts. And so there are 300 of us on campus one day that was wearing these shirts because that's what the shirts in Utah.
Okay, here's your task. You're charged with coming up with 15 artifacts that you think would be perfectly at home in a museum of whiteness. Okay, so if your museum was to celebrate this thing we call whiteness, not just white people.
I was going to say,
whiteness is often thought of as sort of straight people, often pretty male, and white, of course, Caucasian people, the people who have the power and have the money. That's often people strive toward whiteness, whether they have Caucasian skin or not. So if you could think about it, if you can't come up with 15, that's fine. But if you would please, maybe write them on paper for now. We'll put them on the board in a little bit. But see if you can come up with actual physical objects that you would put in a museum representing whiteness. Okay? Give it a go. Call me right if you need anything.
Okay, BMW car, let's say.
A computer.
That's what I was thinking.
I was thinking of a mannequin bus with a white colored shirt and tie.
Suit jacket.
I'm thinking more of material things that have a lot of value. Diamond necklace, diamond rings.
Signs of affluence.
Yes.
But things that they would use, too.
Diamond necklace. Is that the kind of thing?
It certainly could be. My two criteria are that they are artifacts. They're actually physical objects that can be displayed in the museum. And that together, taken together, people went through the museum, they would walk out saying, okay, I get it. That's whiteness. I understand it. All, all these things together represent that. So no one thing has to capture it.
Okay.
So we're going to end up.
Fancy cell phone. The tools of communication.
Fancy
copy
iPods or whatever
they use. We already have the computer, the laptop, right? We look at today's.
And if we're talking about metal, WASP, it may be another, you know, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant male piece of power. I don't know, iPod wouldn't really.
No,
that's more youth.
Or
are we talking about age?
It's
like,
I don't know, a PDA or whatever.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Digital
another
camera.
Communication tool.
A Rolex.
Yeah.
Ah.
Yes.
It might be the cell phone strapped to the 15. It's going to be easy.
I was trying to think of something that would represent wealth. That you had a lot of money in the bank. Of course, you can't display that, but what would signify?
A statement from your portfolio.
A stock certificate.
A credit card.
Credit cards can also be people out of power, though, or in debt.
Yeah.
It would be like your financial statement, but
your platinum card.
Your platinum card.
We could write a statement of wealth that has already stock ownership.
I mean, typically, it's what is your net worth? So it's a financial statement, and it shows when you come to the bottom line, this is your net worth.
Mm-hmm.
But financial statement would be that. That is actually the correct term that you use, personal financial statement.
What do we have so far?
I don't know.
A BMW, isn't it? Hard fizz. Lots of things. BMW, computer, a mannequin with a suit and tie, and a necklace, cell phone, fancy coffee drinks, a PDA, a Rolex watch, and a financial statement.
I also want to intercede that I think fancy coffee drink might blur the image a little bit, because that's also what the iPod on a younger generation trip to. I mean, there's a lot of college students and high school students that view Starbucks.
Yeah, but some people, it's like, it's an American thing.
Yeah.
There was a video playing in England when I went there one time about how Americans drink their coffee through this little spout in the top because it's trendy. And I was like,
how about wine?
Some sort of
nice wine.
Or maybe like scotch, even. Makes it even more expensive.
Scotch or champagne.
Yeah, it's so expensive, luxurious.
What about an SUV? Like a big. Like a Hummer or something.
Yeah. And not just a computer,
could,
I think a laptop.
Could you put a yacht?
Or a little
one.
A big
yacht. I mean, you're now you're talking about
well. I almost, maybe I'm being a little too cynical here, but I'm seeing like a formal legal brief of some sort. Like corporation versus corporation, you know, up there in the tiers of power. I mean, that seems like something that would be way out of reach, you know, up there. And
we could say,
how about a briefcase? Money Magazine?
Fortune.
Yeah.
Wall Street
Journal.
Yeah.
Oh, that's probably
better.
Money Magazine is for kind of middle class.
Wall Street Journal, that's good.
I'm trying to think of all the things I want.
We have 15. Yeah. Anybody, anything else? Does this sound like it? BMW, laptop, mannequin, diamond necklace, a cell phone, fancy coffee drinks, PDA, a Rolex watch, a financial statement from your stock ownership network. Good wine, scotch, SUV, Hummer, yacht, legal brief, a briefcase, and the Wall Street Journal.
Wow, what a life.
You can just...
Everything.
Put them on the whiteboard up there. You can just put a suit and tie, I think, with
that. Now, keep a secret. Don't tell them what this is. Their job when they come in, their first job is to come in and try and figure out what this is a museum of. Just looking at your artifacts, they're going to have to guess what it is.
But the only thing in there that is kind of female-related is the necklace. That is kind of a little out of place we're talking about.
From
a statistics standpoint,
do you think of whiteness as including more feminine elements than what's on your list?
No less. I mean, that's almost like it seems out of place.
No, they got it by
the way.
From a percent point,
yeah.
One 25%, not 25%, one of 25, who's a mathematician, whatever that percentage would be.
You have to have your woman looking good. And
oh, yeah, your trophy wife. Yeah. The trophy wife.
Oh,
yeah.
That
is the necklace.
I knew, but you're making me feel a little bit. Are you ready to leave or what?
What's
over
here
in the necklace? Nikki,
I know.
Yes.
What were you meant?
So things just keep it away and you'll lose the diamond there. You're afraid of losing.
Maybe somebody will pick them up. That'd be interesting.
Yeah, because
it's all male.
It's funny that the only thing that's female related is so trite. And you know, we have tools of communication in cars, and then the only feminine nod is a diamond necklace.
Yeah, but that
well,
could be your
there's also other feminine things would be like your Prada purse or
yeah,
we were just commenting, and that's the only thing that was
there. Yeah,
the necklace is actually ironically kind of a good choice, given that it looks sort of like a collar. Yeah. Really expensive necklace is a way of keeping somebody around.
Trophy
wife.
Exactly.
Yeah,
trophy wife.
I mean, if that's what you're trying to capture, is kind of a culture of consumption and acquisition.
Mm-hmm. But it could throw them off because everything else is kind of male dominated. Yeah. You see that one. Now, what is that?
It's okay to throw them off.
Yeah.
I would say that women share equally with fancy coffee drink
department.
Yeah.
BMW.
Yeah, right.
BMW.
Yeah.
That's so funny.
So those of you, while you folks are writing yours up here, I invite those of you who just came back in the room to look at the whiteboard here. What's your name?
Nancy.
Where Nancy's writing. Nancy's writing up several artifacts. I'd like you to identify, if you can, this is a list of artifacts from a different museum. I'd like you to see if you could identify what is this museum?
I'll write your guesses. Thank you.
It's old.
BMW,
laptop,
technology museum.
Suit and tie, diamond necklace,
newspaper.
Cell phone, fancy coffee drinks, PDA rolls.
This is the success indicators.
Success indicators. So it's a museum of success?
Of success, symptoms, artifacts. I don't want to use
artifacts.
Measures?
Success indicators.
Yeah, success measures.
Success measures indicators. Other guesses?
Soup pastor's garage.
Is that pastor?
No, I was just joking.
Museum of
Affluence.
These are fashion accessories.
They're the fruits of the best American household.
Is that different than this?
Oh, success measures. All of that.
But I'm serious. Do you see what you just said is different than this? The fruits of the best American household?
No.
What else? None of them are what none of them are what I charged them with coming up with.
Not even close, huh?
What are you getting there?
See, I think it's all related to business.
Where do you see business links?
Wall Street gym.
Suits.
Laptops, suit and tie.
Laptops,
cell
phones, PDA.
Rolodex.
Financial statements.
Legal brief.
Wall
Street Journal. Okay. These are the things that people in other countries buy to be more like Americans.
Yeah.
Okay.
Legal briefs?
I like it.
Something that was just said over there, I think is good.
Say it. What's your name?
They said American wannabe.
Yeah, that was.
Yeah. Oh, it says it there.
Well, we were thinking of it before you know
it. If you believe that.
Now, given that you come up with some good descriptors for this list, what do you think I asked them to come up with?
I like the last one.
So to be American means to be what it is that I charged you to come up with? It's interesting.
What Americans would be carrying?
Signs of success.
No, these are more of the benefits.
I guess the financial statement is assumed that there's something on there besides a debit balance.
Positive.
Is that what you had in mind?
It is
positive.
Not.
Museum of lawyer. I mean, look at it. BMW on Hummer, laptop, suit and tie, cell phones, empty coffee drinks, financial statements, Wall Street Journal, briefcase, legal brief. It's a lawyer.
What would characterize, characterize the life of mine? Yeah.
Sister has a quarterback. Or husband.
None of my lawyer would hurt
me. Okay.
Yeah, that's what I'm doing.
We'll come back to this one in a sec. What's their museum?
Middle class America.
No, I wouldn't say middle class America. Plastic surgery would be middle class America.
It's all stuff.
It's all very popular.
Yes.
But for middle class,
yeah, I guess. Yeah.
Everybody's could imagine what this place looked like before.
It's sort of like a history of what we've gone through over time.
Who's we?
The everyday person.
Which everyday person?
Common person?
You dodged my question. So, which country?
America.
Oh, so you're seeing as some
U.S. U.S.
Okay. Now, what similarities and differences do you see between these two lists? Okay, so you home run goal.
I almost wonder if somebody from another country, what they might look at, what they might see watching TV as signs that would say American to them. It's almost like I'd like to ask. I remember asking somebody I met on a beach, what do you guys say? They were French, and I said, our symbol for you is the guy with the French red. And I said, well, what's your kind of stereotype of Americans? And they said, that commercial that shows the guy eating the burger and it's running down his arms. And
the Carl's Jr. thing?
Yeah, and the burger's like this. And I thought, oh, that is so gross of an image of America. So I'm thinking image of America of foreign people looking in on us.
The average American.
That was exactly what I described to this group. What you just said was the picture of America from kind of traditional sense, what people overseas might look at and see this thing. So I want to say what this list is. Yeah, let's keep looking for comparisons and contrasts across the two lists. What do you notice?
We won.
Competition.
No, actually, I think since we got you to figure it out, it means.
The
date books and the PDA. I mean, we were both, it looks like, looking at a focus on carefully managed time.
Well, both the PDA and
the date books,
time management.
Okay, so time management with the PDA, the date book, that's kind of across both lists.
So football. Forms of recreation, albeit different.
Recreation, entertainment.
It's very hard knowing what both of us are now, but what stands out to me about this one is this is, with the exception of the Hummer, a more accessible and commonplace list than a lot of the items that are on our list.
All right.
We got kind of the fast food thing between the fast food counter and
However, my determination is to something you would buy.
We tried to make sure that everything was smile on ours.
You walk in.
Can I have part of
that? That was a really nice food. No, I should have said that. The quintessential.
But image.
Image.
Thank
you. So, appearing a certain way.
Yeah. The surgery, the dieting, the Rolex, the diamonds.
The stuff on this list looks a lot more like what my family could afford to do on vacation than the stuff on this list.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
This feels, I think the word used earlier was more accessible there. So what I charged this group with coming up with, I said, you have to come up with 15 artifacts that articulate for us a museum of whiteness.
Oh.
So, which artifacts, what sorts of things represent whiteness? And they said, what is whiteness? And I said, it's often thought of as straight, white, and pretty male, and generally affluent. And yet we see some links between the two things, some trends. And I asked you folks to come up with a museum of Americanness, and there are some overlaps. You've identified, you know, that a Hummer has become pretty associated with our with Americanness, and also it's a sign of, it's one way you can, you know, get some whiteness for yourself if you can afford to own one of those things. That Americans and people who are white, in that sense, are interested in managing time, not letting it manage us, we manage it. We spend a lot of time thinking about recreation, about image, and that Americanism has become a lot like consumerism. And to be American means to consume more and more. We got that message a lot. That was the hardest message for me to swallow after all the 9/11 stuff happened, was the commercials that came on, government messages saying, you know, help us recover. You go to That was kind of awful.
So, the whiteness stuff is much more exportable. You look at Europe, you look at Japan, you look at China. That stuff's more exported into those other cultures than those things, which are uniquely American, like cowboy hats or something. But it's interesting to me that where there's not overlap, that's nonetheless part of the other cultures of
whiteness. Right. And this is, so this is a way that you can buy your way into whiteness with products that don't even have to stay in this country. You can be living in, you know, South Korea and be relatively white if you can participate in this kind of lifestyle. Become a lawyer, I think you said.
A very odd fact from my time in China, sorry I talked about this all the time, but it was kind of a big event, is that the things that we buy made in China so that they would be cheap here are often much more expensive bought by the Chinese because they are symbols of being American, and so they know they can charge top dollar.
Okay, so it drives the market for them there.
Yeah. And even after the exchange rate.
What about fast food? I assume there's a lot of fast food there. Is that a high...
No, that's cheap.
That's cheap. So that follows...
Food is cheap overall, although McDonald's is relatively expensive, but the cost was quite comparable. Once you went through the exchange rate, $2.50 bought the same thing there as here, but of course, it's 8 times more expensive.
So if you were at yesterday's session, you know, we talked about this notion of an iceberg as a way of looking at a culture, that there's a tip of it that's really visible in American culture. What are some of the things you think are just eminently visible at the top of the iceberg? Well, here you've got many things here that people associate with, if I'm going to be American, if I'm going to look American, if I'm going to be seen as American by people around me, I can adopt these kinds of artifacts and things. Take on some of this surface level stuff. Below that is a level of, just under the water, a level of rituals and myths and norms and ways of doing things that are characteristic of our culture or of Americans. One of the myths we talked about yesterday is the myth of, say, David and Goliath, or the myth of the underdog, and that you might tell a story about yourself, something that happened to you earlier in life. Maybe you came from behind to win a race. Every time you tell the story, you came from a little bit further behind. People were giving you even less of a chance. And, you know, in fact, you only had one leg at that time. More and more so it fits the myth, because that's how we reinforce our place in the culture, is by making our stories fit the cultural story. So that's the second level. And then at the bottom level of the iceberg, see, dark blue, that's where all the values are. That's the cultural values that we hold near and dear. And that's where I want to spend some time tonight, is to think about with you and to talk about with you some of the common sorts of values, yardsticks that you can apply to any culture and then see where you think America falls on some of these yardsticks. I have about a dozen to look at. But when you're looking at cultural values, they really help me figure out not who are we, but also who am I in this world? Who am I if I'm going to be that sort of person? What does it mean to be that sort of person? Make yourself at home. Most of the stuff that's going to be happening now is happening up here, so you won't be able to see. But it doesn't just tell me who I am. It also tells me why. cultural values help explain us. When I look at a stranger's actions and I don't understand them, I assume something about that stranger's value system based on their behaviors. I read into it. I'm always doing inferences, how humans work. We can't know all of what's going on there. They also help give us a boundary. They tell us who's in and who's out. So if I understand cultural values, if I honor those values, I'm in. If I dishonor those values, I'm out to a degree. An example we used last night would be around Holden. One of the values articulated about Holden is that Holden does a lot of decision-making by consensus. That's their goal. And if you were, say, in a position of leadership at Holden and you insisted on making a lot of decisions yourself and keeping other people out, that would have cultural consequences for you in the culture. It's not just a personal decision. So here are some of the things that we look at when you're looking at any culture. Remember now, this is a series about steering the ship. It's not about porting in a particular place. But this is one, these four are really important for understanding about any particular culture. I'm sorry to do this on the wall, but I wanted to make it big enough. It looks a little fuzzy.
It's fine.
It's fine?
Mm-hmm.
Is it okay if I do that?
Yeah.
No,
it's all
fuzzy
there.
All right. So one of the big differences between cultures is whether they value the individual or the collective. It's the most important value dimension that shapes our sense of who we are and what's important for me to do in life. So if you're an individualist, some of the values that really emerge in individualist cultures are things like freedom. Do you hear that one in this country? Don't tell me what to do. Remember when the term politically correct was coined? There were many people in my life, I know, who were perfectly happy treating other people well, and then as soon as they perceived themselves being told to treat people that way, they said, well, I'm not going to do that. You can't tell me what to do. I can talk, I'm a good person. I know how to treat people. Don't you tell me to treat people like that. Even though they've been treating them like that all along, you have a big chip on your shoulder. More mundanely, I can get Tori to clean a room a lot better by asking her to do it than by telling her to do it. So there's that freedom, that autonomy that individualist cultures value. Honesty, social recognition, comfort, I want to stand out, I want to be seen. Personal equity, we like to be kind of status-free, we aren't looking, and we don't like people to put on airs. Hedonism, happiness, comfort. Collectivist values are different. We're most interested in harmony. We're very interested, very careful about making sure that harmony is maintained in every situation. That's very important. And that involves some face-saving. I love this term, too, filial piety, which means respecting your parents' wishes. So things like arranged marriages make perfect sense in a collectivist society. That it's not about making yourself happy, but it's about, you know, this is what my parents think, this is good for my family. And being very concerned about equality and the distribution of rewards among peers, because that helps maintain that sense of harmony and fulfillment of other people's needs. America, U.S. American mainstream culture, where would you place it on this yardstick? Okay, so think of each of these as kind of a continuum. It's not, you know, it's not like this. It's not like either you're this or you're this. But the picture that is a rheostat, you know, that there's somewhere along this line. If, let's say, collectivist is 0 and individualist is 100, where would you put U.S. American?
120. Blow a rheostat.
Other opinions?
I would go 89.
You see some collectivism?
I think we're changing. I think it up until maybe the last 20 years, we have been more focused on the top. But I see it, like at the school level now, more emphasis on peer helping and team building and conflict management training. So I think we're trying to move more toward that or balance it a little bit, but it seems like there'll be a lot of generations before we have enough balance.
Yeah, what do you mean?
Well, I mean,
I'm saying U.S. American mainstream culture. I'm using
101.
Okay. So you really see
all the way off the chart.
Okay. Now, related to what you just said, Jimmy,
Sue.
And you.
I'm Aaron.
Mr. Orphan Aaron. last night, Aaron, you made a point about the individual narrative as still really prominent in American discourse. And we talk about, you know, you can do it on your own. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps, a phrase that has never been able to understand that at all. How would you do it yourself? Doesn't work. But that you had some concerns last night about the validity of that narrative, that in fact the narrative is still there, even though the reality is that we seem to be acknowledging more and more that we need other people and we do our best work with other people, but that the American cultural values-laden narrative still focuses on the individual. So people are starting to question whether that's a valid narrative anymore, but it's still out there. Here's a second one. It's pretty terrible at looking at a screen and at the same time adjusting the screen. Power distance. Some cultures really value unequal power distributions, that it's normal and expected and comfortable to know who's in charge and to know that you are not in charge, you will never be in charge, and that there's a big power distance between you and the people who have the power. The U.S. is much more of a small power distance culture, where you value equal power distributions, equal rights and relations, equitable rewards and punishments on the basis of performance. So if I was teaching a class, one student comes to me, wants an extension on paper, and I say, sure. And another student comes, same class, same paper, and I say, forget it. In our culture, that's, you know, that would get a call to the dean. I would be, it's not fair. In many cultures in the world, to do, that's the norm. You should be applying different standards to different people. That it would be an insult to apply the same standard to every person. But in America, we really value small power distance. Again, we don't like people to put on airs. Ooh, a little too good for us now, huh? You know, you get that sort of, that's legitimate rebuke in American culture. If you think somebody that you think of as a peer is starting to put herself above you, that's a legitimate complaint. So we're kind of a small power distance.
But isn't there a tie between that individualist values and that small power distance as well?
What do you think?
I think so.
Other opinions about that? Do you see a link?
Between what?
Between individualism and a small power distance? Certainly. And it's true that most of the cultures that have been looked at are that these two things do cluster together, and even more clustering together are the collectivist large power distance pieces. But a lot of the collectivist cultures have very well-defined power distance. That's what they do. Here's a third important one. How do we feel about avoiding uncertainty? Do I mind conflicts? Do I mind uncertain situations? So if I'm low in this, I'm really happy with risk-taking and conflict-approaching modes. That means, and that's characteristic of the U.S., that we don't mind uncertainty so much. We're okay trying stuff and then kind of working it out as we go. Other cultures prefer all clear procedures, conflict avoidance. And this will get all the way down to behaviors in which a person will be saying to you, yes, 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 meaning no, 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 because it's so important to maintain harmony and to avoid any kind of conflict. That to say, if I was saying no, that's too much. I can't say no to you. I have to say yes. And the person will eventually figure out that they were actually saying no, but that managed to save face and preserve harmony in that situation for people. This can be very confusing. You know, if you're used to having words mean what they mean.
I know what we're in Mexico as an example. Their culture is like that. If you ask for something, even though they don't have it, okay, yes, I'll bring it to you. But they don't have it, and it never shows up. After a while, you just can't forget about it.
And the temptation is to think of them as stupid. You know? Well, if you didn't have it, why did you say yes? Well, that's why they said yes. Mm-hmm. You know, they're very uncomfortable with having to say no. That's part of that culture. This is an interesting one. The fourth of the big four is a feminine masculine value pattern. And that may not be what you think it is. A masculine value pattern really means rigid sex roles. It means that there's little freedom to deviate from your sex roles. So if you have a feminine culture, societies where social gender roles are fluid and they can overlap, but there are a lot of ways of doing manness, there are a lot of ways of doing femininity. The range is a lot broader. In our own culture, we're a much more masculine culture. The social gender roles are clearly complementary and distinct. And that, you know, that's the one you get sick of this political season, because you know you're going to hear it about everything. I'm tough on marshmallows. focus on task-based accomplishment and success. Women are more subjugated in those societies and are expected to be in that role. And it's a real dilemma for men. It's really interesting just to think about sex roles in U.S. culture. That the number one rule for being masculine in American culture is don't be feminine. And that's the thing that gets you beat up when you're going through middle school. It's one of the things that's very difficult. So when you look at all four of these together, the sub-question of today's session also is, do we worship competition in this culture? Is it a cultural obsession? Is it our civic religion? If you look at all four of these together, where do you see any sort of links either distancing U.S. culture from competition? I mean, we've answered this question already kind of from our gut, but when you look at these characteristics, what do you see about a culture that's individualist, values small power distance, doesn't mind risk-taking, and has pretty rigid sex roles to it? Do you see any of these as having any kind of links with competition? Do you see that as... I should tell you the root of this, too. The reason that I even ever started talking about competition related to intercultural communication is I had my students read a whole bunch of stuff. Undergrads and graduate students read a whole bunch of stuff about... And they have to write discussion questions. They have to write good discussion questions at the analysis, application, or synthesis level. So they're writing complicated questions, and they do a great job when they're writing about anything except readings that challenge competition as anything except human nature and good. Then their discussion questions come out sounding like, well, isn't it true that, or don't you think that, you know, and then out comes some statement about why this author is just flat wrong. And that, you know, that had me scratching my head. So why are we willing to consider all these other things as maybe not so true, but when it comes to competition, people say, oh, no, not that one. You're not touching that one. That one's natural. That one's good. That one's normal. So that made me wonder about competition as maybe the essence of Americans. I found there's a resource in the bookstore, Alfie Cohn's book, No Contest, A Case Against Competition, where he kind of lays out a case. He takes out what he calls our four myths about competition.
Do you call that a sacred cow? Then is competition a sacred cow?
Well, that's what got my attention in class. It seemed like a sacred cow for my students. They were willing to reconsider many things about American culture, but not that.
Do we have other sacred cows in our culture, do you think, besides that?
I don't know. I'm not smart enough to get all of them.
When you brought up uncertainty, we have the U.S. labeled as not necessarily avoiding uncertainty. And I kind of want to challenge that, because I think that if we're looking at this in a cultural sense, it seems to me there's an awful lot of people out there who, when it comes to ethics and politics, are very scared of uncertainty.
Yeah.
And I see these people all the way to the left and all the way to the right, people who, for the life of them, cannot have a fruitful discourse about something that is a deep value.
They won't even start up.
They won't even have. I mean, it'll be, you know, thumping the book on my side, they'll be thumping the book on their side, but they're not actually willing to let themselves slip into the spot and honestly say, okay, I'm not sure about this anymore.
So if that's what counts as low uncertainty avoidance, imagine what high uncertainty avoidance looks and sounds like. There would be no book thumping at all.
Yeah.
In that situation.
I guess so. So, yeah, I mean, I guess if you're in one of those collective societies with a high power distance, you don't need to yell at each other about stuff, maybe.
It's just understood.
Right.
So, follow up a little bit then. What do you think about the role of competition if you see that going on? Do you think competition is an essential part of U.S. culture, or is this...
Well, sure. I mean, I think all too often... And, you know, I've been in state senate sessions, I've been in the Senate assembly, I've been in classrooms. All too often, when you have important issues coming at each other, it's a competition to yell louder or prove your point academically or with a text or something like that, rather than, I mean, and that's a competition, rather than saying let's collaborate to try to figure something out.
Right.
And so,
there were some people had a response to the forum last night. I heard from three different people on the way up the hill was that it felt like people were working things out with each other in the session last night. That people, sometimes forums at Holden, especially about really tough issues, people just kind of get their speeches, cross their arms, and, you know, wait for the forum to be over. They've got a chance to belch, and, you know, everybody else gets to belch, and then it all just kind of smells bad and we go. But it felt like last night was more like what you're describing here, that we were really kind of feeding off of each other's ideas about composition and learning together in public.
I think that the other thing that's interesting to spin off that from is why it's so hard in the church for people to give grace.
To get grace to understand it, you mean?
Yeah. Because if we're in a competition-based context all the time, how abnormal is it to deal with something that doesn't have something related to competition as part of it? And, you know, Dan Erlander did his classic rewrite of whose article, remember the name, on scorekeeping.
Oh, yeah, that booklet. What's it called?
Her name is Herbert, Ann Herbert, an article about in the garden, you know, how it really, we were doing just fine, but then...
The stories of the pointless people.
That's right, that's the one that you're, you know, what does it mean to be engaged in an activity that doesn't earn you anything?
People who no longer keep score.
Doesn't give you social recognition, doesn't let you climb out of the... And the collectivist culture, on the other hand, the saying is it's the nail that sticks out that gets pounded back down with the rest. And we're, you know, in America, you're expected to strive to be that nail.
This discussion idea, what happens when people discuss and people have different opinions, I think how we always brought up, we try to convince someone else that our point of view is right, I'm right, you're wrong, how the competition comes out in that, rather than saying, oh, you have a different point of view, that's really interesting, you know. I may not share that view, but how rare it is for somebody to just accept another point of view rather than just trying to convince that person ad nauseum that you're right and you're wrong.
And you should think that's kind of a competitive
interest. Yeah, that is the competition rather than just, you know, saying, oh, different point of view. Nice. We have to compete in our conversations even.
Does anybody feel differently? I mean, you're hearing a lot of voices here saying, yeah, competition's an essential, or it sounds like it's a key part of what it means to be American. In fact, to be anti-competition could be seen as being anti-American. If you refuse to keep score and you just want to volley in tennis with your friend, eventually they're going to find somebody else they can actually start, you know, playing games against. Something like that. You're supposed to keep score and not...